Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
That's right. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, of course. Good morning to you. Good morning, lurking but cowering conservatives. Conservatives sort of, you know, not having much to stand on these days. It's a beautiful thing. The right is freaking out a little bit. Mark Riley, good morning to you.
Good morning. It does my heart good to see people scuffling and stuttering and unable to figure out what to say next.
Dude, Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh, that dirtbag, gets on the air and starts to try to slander Cindy Sheehan. The one amazing thing about Cindy Sheehan in terms of what the right can and can't say is the bottom line is this woman lost her son in the war, has emotions around that, went down there to stand vigil and to make a statement, to demand attention from the president and having him explain why we're in this war based on lies, why her son had to die. Now people are starting to mobilize. Other families who lost kids are mobilizing to Crawford to stand with her. She has explained and she didn't even have to, I don't think, but she explained the divorce issue. Some people were saying, trying to slander her about her husband leaving her. Well, apparently they'd been separated. The divorce had been going on for a while. The records were just released a couple weeks ago. It was not a timing thing. He did not want that kind of timing. She said that herself. But Rush Limbaugh, the dirtbag, is losing his confidence and also losing his ability to really, be as evil as he possibly can. Because listen to this. Listen, this is Rush Limbaugh talking about Cindy Sheehan.
I mean, Cindy Sheehan is just Bill Burkett. Her story is nothing more than forged documents. There's nothing about it that's real.
What does that even mean?
Including the mainstream media is glomming onto it. It's not real. It's nothing more than an attempt. It's the latest effort made by the coordinated left.
Now the only thing that I like about what he said is that we're coordinated. Now I enjoy that. I'd like to think that we are coordinated, and I hope to God we are. But the one thing he did said that makes no sense to me at all and is heinous is that what is she fabricating? What is Rush trying to point out here? What is she fabricating that she lost her son? I mean, what could she possibly be fabricating?
Look, this is what the right has stooped to in this case. Let's compare, for example, the transparency of Cindy Sheehan's life. Let's leave aside the loss of her son for a moment.
She's got nothing to hide.
Since she's begun this, she has probably become the most transparent woman in America. Mm-hmm. Transparent person.
Uh-huh.
Her divorce, this statement she made, this, her friend, she was friendly with. All of her life has been laid bare and open.
They got nothing.
Now, ask yourself, how transparent is George W. Bush through all this?
Yeah.
How transparent is he in terms of being able to say, look, I understand, and later on we're going to talk about this in some more depth, I understand exactly what you're feeling, or at least I should try to understand what you're feeling, and I will meet with you and talk with you, even though I don't agree with you. It's an amazing thing. Can you think of anybody George W. Bush has met with inside the United States who he disagrees with?
Well, there's one thing I do know is that there is no contrition. There is no attempt. And E.L. Doctorow wrote a beautiful piece. He's one of America's great writers, great historical novels, and a great commentator, and a pretty deep cat. Wrote a beautiful piece. I'm going to read a bit of that in just a few minutes. But let's get into some other stuff here. We're going to obviously talk to Cindy Sheehan, as we do every morning, to see how she's doing. But just that the dirtbag Limbaugh, that he could stoop. It's not even a matter of stooping low. He's got nothing. He couldn't even get up behind it. Talk about lack of transparency. That guy's about as opaque as they come. And the bottom line is that they've got nothing. He's going to call us organized? Well, thank you.
Yeah.
But he's going to call her a fabricator of what? She lost her son. Everything else is on the table. She's not hiding nothing. It's beautiful to me that they are scrambling. And when we take a look at some of these new numbers coming out about Bush, state-to-state numbers. And let me tell you something. Nobody likes this guy.
It's amazing. You ever see those Westerns, Mark, where a guy, the villain, comes out and shoots his gun until there's no bullets left, and then he throws the gun at the guy?
Right.
That's what Limbaugh did yesterday. That's exactly what he did. He's out of ammo,
exactly.
So throw the gun.
And then start running away.
Running away.
I thought you were going to say that about Bush. It feels like that they're all kind of like that. Yeah. Here's a little practical information for you. The Department of Labor reports that consumer prices rose faster than most workers' wages last month as energy costs surged. So that means you got to cut in pay. Is that what that means?
It means not only that you got to cut in pay, But this energy thing is starting to impact the fabric of the American economy, and people should be very afraid of this. This is going to start slowing the economy in ways that we don't even know about.
Yeah, the repercussions of this administration and the way they pillaged this country's money and, you know, kept us in this war and bankrupted this country and put all the wealth into the hands of three people that just happened to be friends of Bush is heinous. In a few minutes, I'm going to read an entire list of records that Bush has broken that have put this world, this country, all the people on this planet and in this country at risk for such heinous liabilities. I mean, this guy has broken some serious records when it comes to depleting the government of money, to ruining the environment, to restricting victims' rights and human rights and individual rights. We got a big, beautiful list that I'm looking forward to reading. But the sad thing is about this wage thing, about the consumer prices and just about the thrust of the economy at this point, is about 7 to 10 workers plan to stay on the job past retirement age. And a lot of people would think, some of these people are like, I just want to stay busy. But it turns out a survey in 2003 by the American Association of Retired Persons found that a lot of older Americans, wanted to keep working to stay active. But unfortunately, when they were asked to specify, what their decision was based on, 22% cited the need for money and 17% cited the need for health care. And these numbers are, this is a sad reality that that you have to deal with here in the way this country is working right now, is that even with certain amounts of health care coverage, maybe Medicare, and the way that thing's been gutted a bit by this administration, is that people that should be able to feel safe in their future, or at least to have some comfort when they retire, are now scared. In 2000, 82% said they'd be financially able to retire by 65. And now in a very recent survey, that number has dropped to 63%.
Let me tell you something. That what did you say? 17% were working, but wanted health care.
Yeah.
Expect that percentage to rise as the baby boom generation continues to age.
Yeah,
see the implication here that a lot of people don't focus on is that if older workers stay in those jobs, guess who doesn't get a chance to compete for them?
Right.
Younger workers. Mm-hmm. And younger workers are going to start feeling impacted by this. There's already a generation that was raised that is resentful of what they see as benefits that the older generation is getting that they don't think they're going to get. That's going to be much, much more pronounced if people stay on past retirement age. If a 25-year-old thinks he's got to compete with a 72-year-old for the same gig.
And also, the other issue is you got a 72-year-old who might be, up to speed, still got his chops, doing a great job, been there for years and years, got seniority, he's got his pension in place. Why would they go on paying that guy when they can get a guy, a third of his age to do it for half his salary? That's the other side of that.
That's the other side.
Is that they'll undercut it, and these guys will be, the older people will be pushed out, which means that they have less to deal with, and the younger people will be gypped because they'll come in and work for nothing.
Absolutely.
It's a lose-lose situation. There's some interesting unfolding evidence that Scotland Yard Commissioner Sir Ian Blair will probably be out of work by the end of the day. We're going to get into that a little later.
What time is it?
Yeah, the countdown to Ian Blair being out of work for, trying to cover up what really happened in the death of that Brazilian man who was shot 7 times in the head because they thought he was somebody he wasn't. This is the slippery slope. This is what racial profiling looks in its most heinous and evil form.
Absolutely.
We're going to talk about that a little bit. I'm looking forward to reading you this E.L. Doctorow, a fragment of this essay he wrote about Bush's inability to understand, comprehend, empathize, or even have a human sense of what death is. It's 15 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark. Hope you're having a good morning.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Folks, tomorrow we'll be doing another great live broadcast when we venture up to Amy Roof's in Harlem.
Yeah.
We'll have pro wrestler Mick Foley, comedian Mike B., best-selling author Bret Easton Ellis, free coffee. They got great food up there. There's going to be giveaways. It's Soul Food and Sedition this Friday morning at Amy Roof's on 116th Street between 7th and Lenox Avenues from 6 to 9 o'clock. Later in the show, folks, If you're a Dave Chappelle fan, his TV show may be dead, but Sony Entertainment is releasing Dave's Uncensored Showtime special on DVD, and we've got a few to give away, so we're going to do a little contest for those of you who like Mr. Chappelle. Also, later in the show, actress Natasha Richardson. We're going to talk to Cindy Sheehan in a little while. Peter Riegert is going to talk about his new film, which is kind of a dark midlife crisis film. In a minute, I'm going to read this E.L. Doctorow, or a segment from this E.L. Doctorow essay that I guess was actually written about a year ago, but the Houston Chronicle, which should tell you something, reprinted it in light of what's going on there in Texas with Cindy Sheehan. Now, yesterday, as you folks might know, the official investigation into the killing of a Brazilian man that Jean-Charles, how do you pronounce his last name?
Jean-Charles Menezes.
Menezes, after the attempted bombing in London, reveals that the truth contradicted the police report, and now Sir Ian Blair, the man in charge of Scotland Yard, is being held to taking the task for basically trying to put in place a cover-up, it seems to me.
3, 2, 1. He's out of a job.
He's out of a job.
Let me tell you how bad this is, Mark. This is really, really bad business. There are published reports in England that now say that the police were told to detain this guy and not to shoot him. The head commander on the scene said, detain him before he got on the train.
So the commander on the scene said, detain him, don't shoot him in the head 7 times.
Exactly. Don't shoot him at all.
Now, apparently, this team of gunmen, the police gunmen, saw him, for like just a matter of seconds.
Before they shot him.
Before they shot him.
Yes.
And then the police gave a completely inaccurate account of what happened during the time they were shooting him 7 times in the head.
They lied like rugs.
Right. He was surrounded on the train by 3 surveillance officers and 4 armed officers. Then an unarmed officer grabbed him in a bear hug.
Yes.
And one of the other guys, started shooting him in the head 7 times.
Yeah.
And now here's the big slip up, which is horrendous because of what it comes down to, is that a soldier, a British soldier that had been assigned to the surveillance detail that was with these, with these cops.
Yeah.
Was in the bathroom.
What? Yeah, he was, quoting here, relieving himself.
He was in the bathroom when he should have been taping the suspect, which might have led to the tape being held against the actual person they were looking for his face, so they would know that it wasn't the guy. See, this is a problem with profiling, folks. This is a series of botch-ups that are unexplainable. And the fact is that most cops there don't carry guns. I just wonder if these guys, on top of just being scared and freaked out and just having experienced a bombing in their city, were a little trigger-happy and didn't know how to deal with this kind of thing.
Well, the botch-ups didn't end with the end of this poor man's life either. There are reports that Sir Ian Blair tried to derail or delay an inquiry into this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some serious problems. And the Menezes' family says that they were dissuaded, or that they had someone from the British government had contacted the Brazilian government to try and get them not to make a big deal out of this.
Wow. So this is a huge cover-up. Heads are going to roll.
Dirty business.
Now, you know that Cindy Sheehan is out there in Crawford standing vigil. A lot of people did their own vigils last night. We're going to talk about that a little later. She's got a lot of people coming out there who lost members of their family in Iraq, sons, daughters, relatives, who are standing with her. And E.L. Doctorow wrote this about a year ago. This is about our president's inability to understand what grief is, because he doesn't know what death is. And this is starting. This is obviously going back and talking about how he came to power. I'll just read a few paragraphs here. And this is E.L. Doctorow. Yet this president knew it would be difficult for Americans not to cheer the overthrow of a foreign dictator. He knew that much. This president and his supporters would seem to have a mind for only one thing: to take power, to remain in power, to use that power for the sake of themselves and their friends. A war will do that as well as anything. You become a wartime leader, the country gets behind you, dissent becomes inappropriate, and so he does not drop to his knees. He is not contrite. He does not sit in the church with the grieving parents and wives and children. He is the president who does not feel. He does not feel for the families of the dead. He does not feel for the 35 million of us who live in poverty. He does not feel for the 40% who cannot afford health insurance. He does not feel for the miners whose lungs are turning black, or for the working people he has deprived of the chance to work overtime at time and a half to pay their bills. It is amazing for how many people in this country this president does not feel. But he will dissemble feeling. He will say in all sincerity he is relieving the wealthiest 1% of the population of their tax burden for the sake of the rest of us, and that he is polluting the air we breathe for the sake of our economy, and that he's decreasing the quality of air in coal mines to save the coal miners' jobs, and that he's depriving workers of their time and a half benefits for overtime because this is actually a way to honor them by raising them into the professional class. And this litany of lies he will versify with reverences for God and the flag and democracy, when just what he and his party are doing to our democracy is choking the life out of it. That's E.L. Doctorow, not my words. And, you know, it's always good to have a great writer's, you know, words to read, because I think that really summarizes a lot of how we're feeling and a lot of, you know, just an encapsulation of this guy's narcissism and his complete incapacity to deal with reality. And this is what's happening along all the conservatives, as we heard from that Rush segment, is that they are desperately trying to manage perception. They are desperately trying to maintain that reality they want people to believe, but it is not reality, and reality is creeping through, as we'll see in those polls.
Yeah, and, you know, Doctorow speaks to something that I think a lot of us have felt for a while and couldn't quite put our finger on what it was. And that is that the America that was supposed to be the example to the world is being lost through these actions. And it's going to take a long time for it to be found again.
Yeah.
You know, those of us who really think that America is supposed to stand as some form of moral beacon, a place where people can look both for opportunity and as an example, that all of that is vanishing before our very eyes under the leadership of this idiot.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that he goes on in another part of the piece to say that the tone of the country, the cultural personality, in a lot of ways, is dictated by the president.
Yes.
And that this president is a non-empathetic, pathological narcissist, it creates that. And one thing I realized about this is that his inability to feel really plays into a sort of, you know, a denial, a type of tough love denial, a belligerence, a type of contempt and anger that it manifests itself in a lot of the working class of this country. Because when you see people getting out there, either throwing, driving over crosses in Crawford, or saying that Cindy Sheehan is not patriotic or she is un-American, anybody who can say that without any conscience is pathologically broken. There's something wrong with them inside. They don't. They no longer have the ability to feel. Their anger has taken over their brain. And I think he panders to that.
Oh, he does, most definitely.
So which state hates Bush the most? You want to know? We'll tell you in a second, because it's really surprising just how much contempt there is for this president out there. We're going to get into that a little bit when we come back. We're also going to tell you just how he screwed this country and this planet over in a very decent list. 27 past the hour, Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey,
good morning. Wake up, sheeple. How are you? It's Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. We are we're in the middle of it here. We're going to be doing a Chappelle DVD giveaway in just a few minutes, so hang in for that. I'm also going to be reading to you a list of the great achievements of the Bush administration. And you know, if you listen to the show regularly, that I'm saying that with a dripping amount of sarcasm. Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily, we have an iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's feed it some headlines. Here we go. From the USA Today. Okay. AOL worker who stole email list sentenced. AOL worker who stole email list sentenced. Sentenced. Translation. Convicted AOL worker gets 15 months worth of free minutes. Ooh. From Business Week, Windows users battle new computer worm. Windows users battle new computer worm. A translation, Steve Jobs unveils latest creation. From the Associated Press, Madonna breaks bones while riding a horse. Madonna breaks bones while riding a horse. Translation, photo shoot for new Madonna sex book turns tragic. Oh. Yes. All right, so we're going to do this. We're going to get into these beautiful polls, I say. Bush approval ratings Bush approval polls. This is great. They've dropped to 41% nationwide. 41% approval rating nationwide. Nobody likes this guy. This is a fascinating poll because it was done on a state-to-state basis. All right. His lowest approval rating is in Rhode Island at 29%. His highest approval rating is in Idaho at 59%. His highest is 59%, all right? 9 states give him a 50% or higher approval rating. 16 states give him a 40% or lower. So you know what that means? This red state, blue state thing is crap. This whole idea that there are red states and blue states, you've drank the Kool-Aid. There is no red state, blue state. There is not that. There is no places. There may be cities, there may be towns, there may be neighborhoods where liberals, progressive, Democrats feel surrounded by conservatives. But I think that a lot of what people are experiencing is their own self-censoring, their own fear that they are, because this is just propaganda that has become malignant. There is no red state, blue state separation. 41% of the people in this country like the guy. All right? That's pretty low. 41%. And the highest is in Idaho. What the hell happens in Idaho? Well, they got, like, you know, survivalist encampments and TM centers. And that's the yin and the yang of Idaho. But, of course, it is a great retreat for the more malignant militia organizations that thrive in this country.
What we're seeing, I think, is the middle of the country in particular. If you look at this polling data, the middle of the country is beginning to lose faith with this president at an alarming, alarming rate. Places like, for example, your home state of New Mexico, places like Minnesota. You're talking about, approval drops in some cases as high as 20%. That's in Minnesota.
How about Ohio, dude? Ohio, 37% approval rating. Ohio, this is where the voter fraud took place. This is where, they were all on the fence. This is where the Democrats should have, gone in. They should have had a landslide in Ohio with this many people on the fence. 37% approval rating. Now, granted, as I've said before, there are still people waiting online to vote there. But nonetheless, 37%. It's mind-blowing, dude.
It's mind-blowing, and it's mind-blowing for a number of reasons. By the way, the governor of Ohio has just gotten indicted on some charges, so I don't know. Maybe they dig a little deeper, they find out something going on with Debo, too. But that's another discussion for
uh-huh.
What we're seeing here is one group of people who are impacted by these numbers more than any other single interest group, and that's the Congress of the United States.
Yes.
These people are scared to death that these approval ratings or disapproval ratings are going to translate next year into Republican seats lost in Congress, in the House and in the Senate.
Well, it's like I said before, hey, Tim the librarian, can you get that Rush Limbaugh thing on cue? You don't have to play it just yet. But what we're seeing here is the conservative momentum of propaganda is starting to break apart. All these guys do is try to repeat themselves. They do these mantras, these chants of belligerence, these chants of hatred, these chants of fabrication that kind of hold together a poetic reality for people that are fueled by hate. Now, what's happening is that reality that they're creating for the country through their talking points is starting to break apart because people are starting to feel again. They're starting to, come out of their fear. They're starting to, listen to the truth a little more, seeing the facts. When the number one conservative pundit, blowhard, dirtbag, says this about a woman who lost her son, all right, and is down there, basically re-engaging the peace movement. Peace should be important, especially in a situation where a war was based on lies and you got 1,800 plus kids dead. Now, this is the best they have. This is their guy. This is Rush Limbaugh, talking about Cindy Sheehan.
I mean, Cindy Sheehan is just Bill Burkett. Her story is nothing more than forged documents. There's nothing about it that's real. Including the mainstream media is glomming onto it. It's not real. It's nothing more than an attempt. It's the latest effort made by the coordinated left.
That's really thin, man. That's really thin. I do thank him for the compliment. Yes, we are coordinated. But to call Cindy Sheehan a liar, what is she lying about? That she lost her kid? Who would believe that? What kind of programmed robotic hate machine would believe what the hell he is saying? Now, this is the amazing thing. 59%. This is the highest rating he has. That's in Idaho. Okay? Now, dig this. Now, no president hasn't even been to Idaho since 2000, and that was Clinton. All right? And he was there, doing some campaigning, sure, for Kerry. But here we go. Today, or next week, George W. Bush is going to Idaho. I'm sorry, did I say Ohio? Is going to Idaho. Yeah. Right, Idaho is where he has a 59% approval rating, the highest in the country. He's on vacation, okay? He's got a woman that is demanding attention for him to explain his war. He's got protesters almost on his property. So what does he do? I need to go someplace where people like me. I need to go, you know, I want to feel loved again.
He doesn't want to hear bad news.
He's taking a vacation from his vacation.
Yes.
And he's going to Idaho. He's going to fly in on his helicopter. He's going to go to a golf and ski resort there, maybe take a swim or, you know, play a few holes. And then he's flying to this 12,000-seat-plus auditorium to talk about terrorism to people in Idaho. Idaho.
Well, remember, carefully screened people. In Idaho, there won't be any dissenters. And remember that even with a 59% approval rating, 36% of the people in Idaho disapprove of him. Don't think for a minute any of them are going to jam into this 12,600-seat arena where Bush will be speaking.
But what kind of, where is he living? See, this is like, is he being protected from reality? Is this guy that detached? I mean, I know he rides bikes. I know he says he's got to get on with his life. I know there are dozens of people dying every day in Iraq. He's got a woman who's demanding attention. He's got an active peace movement. He's got people that have lost kids on his property almost, demanding attention. But he's going to Idaho, where he's got the highest approval rating, to talk about terrorism.
But hey, he's on vacation.
If he wanted to talk about terrorism, what's he going to say? That is actually the only thing that is flourishing in Iraq? I mean, human death and the number of terrorists are the only things that are growing in Iraq right now. Is he going to tell that to the 59% of the people of Idaho that like him? Is he going to be honest about that?
Well, probably not. I mean, there's not a lot of honesty in this guy, and that is because he doesn't want to hear any bad news. He does not want to confront bad news publicly. That's why even his colleagues in the Congress, his Republican colleagues in the Congress, are saying that this constant, well, we're making progress in Iraq. It won't hold. It's not holding with the American people. That's what these numbers are telling everyone.
It's interesting. It's interesting, Riley, because he's probably going to go to one of the only states in the union where you can pretty much be guaranteed that there are some white terrorists.
Yeah.
You know, right there in the audience. And oddly, not so coincidentally, the day before he goes there, Cheney's going up there to kiss some ass and try to get some money for the Senate race of the guy up there.
Yeah.
All right? Now, this is like, if the American people can't see through this crap, if you can't see through the fact that, you know, this is the only state in the union that likes this guy, and even that margin is 59%, that he's going there instead of addressing the needs of the American people in terms of, like, why? Why are my kids dying? Why is this war going on? Why can't you tell the truth? Why can't we figure out some plan to get our kids home? Why can't you answer these questions? I'm going to go to Ohio where people like me and talk about terrorism to potential terrorists. Idaho. I keep saying Ohio. Sorry. Idaho.
But you know what?
Idaho.
All those questions that you just asked, he's got no answers for. That's why he's not speaking to any of them. He doesn't have an answer for Cindy Sheehan. If he lives to be 100, he'll never have an answer for Cindy Sheehan. He'll never have an answer for any of the more than 1,800, and we're creeping up toward 2,000 now, Mark. More than 1,800 people who have lost their lives, and, you know, double-digit thousand people who have come back wounded.
All right, you know, this is getting so heavy this morning, but it's okay. This is a reality. This is the country you live in. The only thing that I can say is celebrate the fact that the misperception, the non-reality that the conservative propaganda arm is creating is starting to shatter, you know, by no small, whatever the saying is, because of Cindy Sheehan.
Oh, yeah,
I gotta
no
be honest
doubt.
With you. And, yeah. And when we come back, not on a comedic level, but on a very succinct level, I want to lay out exactly the type of records that Bush is breaking under his leadership and just what that's doing to the United States and its standing in the world. Also, we're going to be giving away a Chappelle DVD, so hang out for that. And you know, of course, we've got the Cliff Notes coming up. So it's 44 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
49 past the hour. Good morning. How's it going? It's Morning's Edition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
How's it going?
You're listening to Air America Radio. We're getting into it. We're going to give away a CD, a DVD, a Chappelle, Dave Chappelle's Uncut Showtime Special. That's going to be in just a few minutes. We're going to give that away because we got a bunch from Sony Pictures Home Entertainment. It's pretty funny. It's Dave Chappelle for what it's worth. And so you Chappelle fans, get ready to answer a Chappelle trivia question in just a second. Right now, if you're just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for Morning Sedition's Cliff Notes. A state-by-state poll reveals that President Bush is most disliked in Rhode Island and most popular in Idaho, a state he's never been to. If Bush's goal is to get the United States to hate him as much as the rest of the world, it's working. Pollsters note that if the presidential election was held today, not only would Bush lose to John Kerry, he would lose to Jim, Drew, or Mariah Carey as well. An AARP poll shows that many people say they plan to work after retirement. People already notice elderly workers, particularly when telemarketers start out phone calls selling timeshares but end them with some long, rambling story about their gallbladder operation. A long, rambling story about their gallbladder operation. There we go. A testing agency is warning that many incoming freshmen are not prepared for college. At last, Bush finally has a solution to the problem of dwindling enlistments. On the bright side, these unprepared freshmen are expected to major in broadcasting. So welcome aboard, guys.
Hey.
Yeah. On the another positive note, 98% could down a six-pack in 2 minutes and 15 seconds flat and still practice safe sex. So, you know, it's not all bad. Some of these guys are more talented than you think.
Some guys can do that?
I think so. That's what I hear. That's the kind of...
I haven't been able to do that in 30 years.
That's according to the poll. That's according... Yeah. That's a, here we go. So let's do this now. What is George Bush doing? What exactly is he doing to this country and to this planet? He's breaking records. Breaking records, folks. Here are a few of them. The trade gap is on pace to top $780 billion for the year. That's a sharp increase from last year's record, $617 billion. Record trade deficits are pushing the U.S. to borrow a record $2.1 billion each day to keep the economy afloat. Where's that money coming from? A lot of it's coming from China, isn't it, Riley?
Mm-hmm.
After setting a record for the longest job slump since the Depression in his first term, Bush is now presiding over a decline in labor participation. Over 500,000 people, 20% higher than a year ago, have simply given up looking for a job.
Since half a million people.
Unbelievable. Since its founding, America produced a national debt of $5.7 trillion. Since its founding, Riley. But since Bush took office, the debt is expected to almost double to $10.8 trillion in 2010. Since the beginning of Bush's second term, the dollar slid to a record low when it fell 24% against the euro, 14% against the yen, and 21% against the Canadian dollar.
Mm.
Consumer debt set a record of $2 trillion in 2004, and personal bankruptcies set an all-time record in 2003. That's one out of every 73 households, Riley. One out of 73 households in 2003 declared bankruptcy. Now with new legislation, all you people, you know, who are strapped or have problems or hit financial hard times, you want to declare personal bankruptcy?
Nah.
Can't do it. So now you're going to be held, you know, he's just making these bankruptcy courts credit collectors. It's unbelievable. While not a record when adjusted for inflation, oil prices are setting new highs. In August, oil reached $67 a barrel, setting 5 consecutive records in 1 week. The profits for oil conglomerates set a record $100 billion worldwide in 2004. Since Bush took office, oil profits increased by 34%. This is what he's doing. This is what our president's doing. Is he talking to Cindy Sheehan? No. Is he going to Idaho where he has a 59% approval rating, the highest in the country, to kiss some ass? Yes, he is. Is he incapable of being empathetic with the true needs of the American people? Yes. Is he a pathological narcissist guilty of murder? Yes. Okay. Pharmaceutical conglomerates also claimed higher profits. During the recession of 2002, the largest 10 drug companies in the Fortune 500 reported combined profits of $35.9 billion, more than the profits of all the other 490 businesses combined.
Wait a minute. Didn't all that money go to their employees?
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, sure.
They got raises, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I mean, the line guys, the guys that do the grunt work.
Oh, sure. Know. Yeah, the guys making the pills.
Yeah.
Oh,
they,
sure.
They
everybody gets a raise.
Living like kings. Right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You get free pills.
New mortgage.
Yeah. Under Bush's business-friendly administration, U.S. corporate profits accounted for 11% of the GNP in the first quarter of 2005. That's the highest in four decades. Friend-o-business, George Bush.
Yeah.
The wealthiest 20% of households increased their share of income from 44% in 1973 to 50% in 2002.
That's a good thing, isn't it?
It is, but it's only
6%.
But compared to this, in 2002, the wealthiest, right, one-tenth of the 1% of this has the highest share of the nation's income since the 20s. So we're back to those days.
Oh.
You know, robber barons.
Wow.
Yeah, sure.
Do I know anybody? Do you know anybody like that?
That makes that much money?
Yeah.
I don't know if I do. I think I have a cousin that works in the market.
Mike Bloomberg.
Yeah. Yeah, Mike Bloomberg.
The mayor of New York.
Can you even fathom how much money that is? Under Bush's newly extended power to declassify documents, some 125 government documents were classified secret every minute in 2002, setting a record of 15.6 million classified documents, double the number since 2001. So he's just continually stashing stuff, hiding it from the American people. In June, the French gave America the lowest approval rating in 17 years, with only 31% having sympathy for Americans. See, we've embarrassed ourselves in front of more progressive countries. The U.S. occupation of Afghanistan has been a boon to drug dealers there who earned a record $2.2 billion in 2004. But I thought we cleaned that place up.
That's only what they declared.
Right. I guess there's no more terrorists, but there's plenty of opium for everybody.
Yeah, but you know what? Mark Maron, you predicted this well over a year ago.
Of course. It's a huge business. Huge business. All right, folks.
James.
All right. You know what that means, don't you, Riley?
No.
Okay. All week we've been giving away copies of Dave Chappelle's Uncensored Showtime special, Dave Chappelle for What It's Worth, on DVD. That's courtesy of Sony Pictures Home Entertainment. We're asking listeners to guess what character Dave Chappelle is doing in clips from Chappelle's show. For instance, yesterday someone identified this.
M-A-R-S. Mars, bitches. That's where we are going. Mars. Red Rocks.
Yay, yay.
That's Dave Chappelle doing a black President Bush. All right, so here's the next clip, and the first caller to get it right when we open the phones will win Dave Chappelle's Uncensored Showtime special on DVD. Ready? Here we go. Since we've only got two DVDs left, this one's going to be a little harder. Who is Dave playing here?
The only way I open the studio up now, y'all got to walk uptown to the Bronx and get breast milk from a Cambodian immigrant. Breast milk.
All right, you got that? Let's play it again just because it's so damn funny.
The only way I open the studio up now, y'all got to walk uptown to the Bronx and get breast milk from a Cambodian immigrant. Breast milk.
All right, the phones are now open, 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. We'll get a winner when Morning Sedition continues, and if you can't get through, you're going to have a final chance to win in the show a little later on, so stay tuned.
What?
Stay tuned.
What?
Stay tuned.
Yeah!
All right, later in the show, we've got Natasha Richardson is going to be here to discuss her new film. We've got Peter Riegert.
Yes.
Is going to, you know, many people know him from Animal House, but I'm sure he gets tired of that. He was also, I believe, the congressman on Sopranos. Was he a congressman or a senator?
Wasn't he assemblyman?
Assemblyman, right. Yeah, the assemblyman who Tony Soprano beat the hell out of for having sex with his ex.
Uh-oh.
You know, the sleazy, slimy assemblyman. He's got a personality like that. All the characters he plays are a little slimy, but in this new movie, he kind of breaks through that and he gets real. It was a pretty good film. I watched it last night.
Now, you know what else we got?
What?
Radio Theater!
And Cindy Sheehan will be here. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. It's 57 past the hour. Six past the hour, it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. You're listening to Mark Maron and Mark Riley. I'm Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Yeah.
Good morning to you. It's Thursday. Tomorrow morning, we are going to be at Amy Ruth's in Harlem. You know, if you want to come down for that, 6 to 9 a.m., there's going to be free coffee, giveaways. Me and Pops Riley will be up there in Harlem with professional wrestler and socially aware guy, Mick Foley, writer, author, jack of all trades. Mike B., very funny comedian, is going to be up there. I haven't seen Mike in a little while. He's a funny guy. Bret Easton Ellis is going to be up there talking to us. That's at 116th Street between 7th and Lenox Avenues. Yes.
Malcolm X Boulevard and Adam Clayton Powell.
There you go. See, that's a little something I didn't know. I just learned something today. I've been schooled. That's tomorrow morning at Amy Ruth's. I'm looking forward to that. We got people on the phone. We got winners on the phone. We were giving away a Dave Chappelle a DVD. This is of course the Dave Chappelle for What It's Worth, the uncut Showtime special given to us by Sony Pictures Home Entertainment. Let's go through what people had to guess again. This is the character that you had to guess from the Chappelle show. What do you got?
The only way I open the studio up now, Y'all gotta walk uptown to the Bronx and get breast milk from a Cambodian immigrant.
All right, so.
Breast milk.
I'm sorry, I interrupted the best part both times.
Breast milk.
What?
All right, here we go. We got a winner on the line. Maybe. Maybe. What's that? Let's see if she knows the answer. Mary, how are you?
Hey, guys.
What's
hey,
going
Mary.
On?
Not much.
Yeah, so who is Dave Chappelle playing right there?
He is doing Sean P. Diddy Combs from Making the Band.
But wait a minute. What's his new name, though? I mean, you got to give
well,
us
it's just Diddy now.
All right. Okay. There you go. So you get to hear the fun noises, and you get to win a DVD.
Yeah.
Yes.
Listen to a lot of hip-hop, do you?
I love hip-hop. I love Chappelle, and I'm glad you're not giving away the season because we already have both of them.
Do you love what radio show do you love, though, really?
What I really love is Morning Sedition.
Oh,
there we go.
See,
hey, get that on CD, folks.
I'm fishing.
There's money in the bank.
There's a new promo from Mary, and you're out there in Brooklyn?
Yeah, in Brooklyn.
Well, thanks for playing, and stay on the line. They'll get the information from you.
All right, thanks, guys.
Okay,
thanks,
take it easy. All right, there you go. Made another person happy.
Yeah, man.
Another person happy. And we gave her something she didn't have, Riley.
That's right.
She didn't have it.
Maybe she'll come uptown tomorrow, too.
Oh, maybe. I mean, I wonder. I'm
curious. Get in spirit.
You know, I'm really curious to see if our regulars come up to Harlem.
Let me tell you something.
Yeah.
Around the corner from Amy Ruse,
okay,
there's a place that was a club that used to be called Harlem World. It was one of the early, early hip-hop clubs in the late 70s. That's
wow.
How you know. Yeah, and I played music there one night.
No kidding.
I played records at Harlem World. I was a fish completely out of water because I didn't know that much about hip-hop at the time. And I went up there, and, you know, I was a downtown club person.
Right.
So I'm thinking, I'm going up there, I'm going to just play records.
Downtown club meaning? Disco?
No, man. The love. This private underground place.
Okay,
man.
All right.
The disco.
I just want to make sure.
No!
I mean, there was an evolution from disco to the downtown club
scene.
No.
Which was there was a downtown club scene that from which disco emerged.
Oh, there
different.
You go. Sorry,
yeah.
Man. Sorry.
But no, Harlem World, which is now, I think, a supermarket or something.
That's sad, isn't it, when that happens?
Yeah.
When you look at a place wistfully, remembering all the bad stuff you did in there. You're kind of walking around. It's like, wow, this meat aisle was where the couch was.
Yeah, yeah. It was unbelievable. And the thing was, I went up there, and in those days, they wanted the person playing records to start rhyming over the music. I had never rhymed over any music before.
Oh, dude.
So they keep saying, are you going to say anything, man? Are you going to say anything? I said, no, I'm not going to say anything. That was my one and only trip to Harlem. No, man, I stayed there till 6 o'clock.
That's hilarious. So yeah, you stayed all night, they wanted you to rhyme, you bailed out, and you were too ashamed to go back.
That's right.
I'm not going back there if they're going to make me sing.
See, that's right.
I've been that way. My wife does this karaoke thing.
Really?
And I am so, like, I am, you know, I'll go on stage, I've made a fool out of myself, I've done everything but cry and wet my pants on a comedy stage, but at a karaoke thing, I just choke up, dude. I mean, I get paralyzed with fear, and I don't have a bad voice. I can pull it off.
I'm sure you could. I never was into karaoke. I always thought karaoke was kind of unhip.
It is, but it's kind of it's hip in L.A. because it's unhip. You know how things sort of come full circle?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Like, everybody seems to do it. And my wife sings Crazy Train by Ozzy Osbourne, and she does a couple of Neil Diamond numbers. And she,
which
she,
ones?
I don't remember Solitary Man.
Really?
Yeah. She gets into it. I mean, people who get into it, it's very surprising when you watch someone do karaoke because you think you know a person. Then all of a sudden they get up there and they got this beautiful voice. Or some people get lost in song.
Yeah.
You know, I envy people, actually, who are able to do that. Song and dance people. Like, I watch Dean Martin. I see musicals. I'm not a big fan of musicals, but I wish that I could do a song and dancing. I wish I wasn't so self-conscious. Is that weird?
No. Let me tell you something. The one time I happened to be in a bar, I forgot where it was, where they were doing karaoke. And, you know, when you get that series of people that just, their voices are just like,
yeah, yeah.
Well, there were like five people, and they all got up, and they were like kick-ass songs, but they were going,
yeah, they freak out.
I left.
Yeah, they freak out. Yeah, and it's so horrifying when somebody doesn't pull it off because, you know, they come off stage, like, hey, well, you know. Yeah, but even that's kind of cool because the vulnerability of it all. Anyways, we don't need to go on and on. And we're going to be in Harlem was the bottom line of this story.
Line,
so let's make a segue into this. Today in history, in 1963, I was about a month away from being born, but James Meredith, on this day in 1963, was the first African-American to attend the University of Mississippi. He graduated with a degree in political science. His enrollment a year earlier was the cause of some deadly riots that, of course, I don't remember. I wasn't born. I'm not educated.
I remember the riots at the University of Mississippi, and I also remember that after he graduated, James Meredith led a march, and he got shot by a sniper.
Oh, man.
I mean, this was, people probably don't remember, this is over 40 years ago now, and I was a small kid, but people don't remember how oppressive things used to be back then.
Back then, it's not even 50 years ago. That's what I can't believe. Back then is a month before I was born. I cannot believe some of this stuff went on in this country and continues to go on. It's just, it's devastating to me, and it's just, no wonder there is still so much tension within this culture, and there's still, you know, there's, I get kind of worked up about it, because I was thinking also in terms of, like, when you deal with a situation where you have an oppressed minority for a number of years, like, you know, even when you think in terms of what's going on in Iraq right now, Riley, when you think in terms of the Shias and the Sunnis being the oppressors for so many years, and now they're on the other side of that, how is that ever going to end?
It's going to be very difficult. And part of the reason why it's going to be difficult is because Iraq was a foreign construct to begin with. Britain formed Iraq, you know. This wasn't a matter of Sunnis, Shias, and the Kurds. Hey, let's all get together and form our own nation and live together in peace and harmony. The Brits did this.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, George Bush Sr. knew that if George Bush Jr. got into this crap, that he was going to
be
there forever.
Yeah.
What goes on there? Yesterday, you know, 3 car bombs killed 43 people. All right. The first 2 bombs went off shortly before 8 a.m. And about 15 minutes later, the third bomb exploded. Police and medics were among the dead. This is what's going on in Iraq every day. The toll of Americans is rising, you know, on a weekly basis. We've got Cindy Sheehan out there at Crawford Ranch protesting, demanding an explanation from this president who is incapable of dealing with reality and understanding death. This is a president that has not gone to one military funeral. And what is he doing next week? He's flying to Idaho because that's the only state where his approval ratings are the highest, and even that is 59%. He's flying to Idaho to go to a golf and ski resort and then speak about terrorism to an audience in Idaho, and that's 2 days after Dick Cheney goes up to Idaho to try and pander and kiss some ass and get some money for a senatorial candidate up there. This is what the president is doing when he's got protesters on his property demanding that he address the death, the senseless death that's going on a day-to-day basis in Iraq.
Absolutely, and of course, this kind of carnage, and it's been stepped up over the last couple of weeks or so, this kind of carnage increases pressure on the existing Iraqi government to do something. If people are being killed off in these kinds of numbers in your country, I don't care where it is, Baghdad or L.A., people are going to start demanding that elected officials, people that you put in power, do something to stop this violence, and the Iraqis are powerless.
That's right. You know, this world is getting more and more frightening, and on an economic level, what this administration has done to this country is just heinous. I have no idea what the future holds, and on some level, you know, I'm thankful, I don't have kids. Is that a bad thing to say? But I am concerned about whether or not my cats will go to college.
See that? I'm thankful I have a child because my daughter's up listening. Hi, Vivica.
No, kids are great, but, you know, I just know with my own personal panic, and I guess everyone does it, you know, you panic a little bit about, well, what's the future hold? And I'm sure, you know, I want to be hopeful. I want to have some faith in something that's vague and not completely defined to me, but I do have faith. When we come back, we're going to have the new edition of Morning Sedition Radio Theater. So stick around. Congratulations to Mary out there in Brooklyn for winning the Chappelle DVD. Was that her name, right?
Yeah.
And I'm glad that people are having a good time with that. 16 past the hour. We got Peter Riegert coming as well, and Cindy Sheehan a little later in the show. I hope you're having a good morning. It's Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark.
Morning Sedition, Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Don't just stare at it. Eat it.
On Air America Radio.
Sedition old-time radio players present this installment of Morning Sedition Radio Theater.
This week, Morning Sedition Radio Theater presents The L Word, with Mark Maron as Jenny, Mark Riley as Dana, and a special surprise guest star.
Haven't you ever been to a bar before?
Not a woman's bar. By myself?
This is like something out of the 1950s. It's so butch and femme.
Well, it's the oldest lesbian bar in L.A. Actually, it probably hasn't changed since the 1950s. But really, it's no different than any other club. You know, I mean, you have a few drinks, you talk to a few people you have nothing in common with, and you realize how unlikely it is you'll ever meet anyone who's right for you again.
Wow. Who's that woman?
I don't know, but she's coming over.
Excuse me, ladies. I just moved into town from Chicago, and I'm still meeting people out here. Can I buy either of you gals a fuzzy navel?
Don't you think you're being a little forward? We don't even know your name.
I'm Jane Gillen.
This has been The L Word on Morning Sedition Radio Theater.
21 past the hour, Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Lock the doors. Gilman's coming.
Oh, Gilman is never going to live that down. He's going to be Jane Gilman from here on out, isn't he? Oh, my God. So we got Peter Riegert coming in. He's going to he's got a new movie out that's, you know, many of you remember him as this.
Whale Otis sees us. He loved us.
he was booing in Animal House, and I'm sure that, you know, that is the bane of his career on some level. Though
he was funny, though.
He was funny. You know, but you got to figure that, you know, you do a whole, you have a full career of work. You do a lot of acting, but you know, it's one of those career defining roles where he goes out in the street, and no matter where he is, he's like, that's the guy from Animal.
But I'll tell you, I always remember Local Hero because that's one of my favorite movies.
That's a beautiful movie, and this new movie, King of the Corner, is one of these films that there's been a couple of them out, type of film where you have a guy who's in a midlife crisis in a way. You know, he's at a job where a young guy is trying to come up and take his job. And I'll tell you, Riegert's film, which he co-wrote and directed, is a little darker than the other ones I've seen. And it definitely shows a part of a humanity that I found. It's a compelling movie. And Eric Bogosian, our buddy Eric Bogosian.
Oh, he's in it?
Yeah, he's in it. He's got a big role.
Excellent.
And Dominic Chernese from The Sopranos.
Yeah.
Uncle Junior is in it. He's got some great acting in it. Beverly D'Angelo is in it, but we'll talk to him about that in just a few minutes. You know, we were talking yesterday about Democrats, and, you know, they're sort of kind of rolling over on the Roberts nomination, whether or not John Roberts will get any fight at all. And Patrick Leahy, the Democratic senator from Vermont, will lead the questioning of John Roberts during his confirmation hearing before the Senate. There might be hope at the very least for an engaging and spirited bit of interrogation, because Leahy said yesterday that Roberts was, quote, among the most radical being offered by a cadre intent on reversing decades of policies on civil rights, voting rights, privacy, and access to justice, end quote. Leahy didn't say he would oppose the appointment. That's staying in line with Minority Leader Harry Reid's request to wait for the hearing before making decisions. But Reid actually said, look, all this talk about whether we're going to support Roberts or not is laughably premature, he said. The hearings have not even begun yet.
You know, each one of these senators in the confirmation hearings, the senators on the Judiciary Committee, will get 50 minutes. That's almost an hour to ask this guy questions. I at this point, am going to maybe go out and buy a DVR so I can watch Patrick Leahy question John.
It's going to be good, and I think that, like what you said, you actually gave me a little hope, you know, in terms of, like, all of these documents that are just, you know, just now showing up, that you never know what's going to happen. Maybe something will come up. Maybe something will turn up. Maybe something will turn this thing around, because you said you just don't know. You just don't know.
No, you never know what's in a nominee's past, and, you know, you should be suspicious a little more when the White House is reticent about giving over documents.
Right.
Okay? When they start saying, well, I'm not sure if we want to give you this one, and I'm not sure if we want to give you this set of them, there may be something there. Now, maybe not in this guy's case. We don't know. But it's not over yet.
But this White House will keep anything secret that they can. They love doing that. It's one of their favorite things to do.
What was that, 100-and-something documents a day?
They just stash them.
Well,
just
classified.
Yeah, why not? Don't even bother looking at them. Just stash them, and we'll go through them when they want them.
Right.
Coretta Scott King, the widow of Martin Luther King, was hospitalized yesterday. The 78-year-old King suffered a stroke on Wednesday and is in fair condition at Piedmont Hospital in Atlanta. If you want to send flowers, the family has released a statement expressing thanks for the outpouring of care and support that's being sent from around the world.
Yeah, the King family's not discussing her condition. However, the hospital is saying, Piedmont Hospital is saying that she may be staying in the hospital for at least one more day. And they say that her vital signs have stabilized. So that's good news. That is definitely good news.
Yeah, that is good news. Have you interviewed her before, Riley?
Yes, I've talked to her before. I've talked to the Reverend Joseph Lowry, who's, of course, head of the Southern Christian
Leadership.
And he
made a statement on behalf of the family yesterday.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
So the Department of Labor reports that consumer prices rose faster than most workers' wages last month. That means you took a cut in pay and you didn't even know it.
Right.
This is because of energy costs surging again. And as Riley said earlier, we don't even know what kind of havoc the energy issue is going to wreak on the economy in the near future.
No, we don't. And see, it's right now we're in a season where people are not altering their consumption plans as far as gasoline and that sort of thing. People kind of decide ahead of time whether they're going to the shore, if you're in the New York area or whatever. So people are going out and they're buying this gasoline. Watch what happens after Labor Day. Watch what happens when people actually have to get back to work and they start really, wait, it's costing me $60 to fill my pump and fill my tank here.
I'll tell you what frightens me is that, people, like it, just on this little factoid, consumer debt set a record of $2.1 trillion in 2004, and personal bankruptcy set an all-time high in 2003. One out of every 73 households went bankrupt for whatever reason. And that was before they put this legislation in place. It made it almost impossible. It makes it almost impossible to declare personal bankruptcy when you actually hit hard times and need to get back on your feet. So I just would recommend that you be careful. I mean, if you're getting into debt and you're buying too much, I mean, I know you think you need it, but just be careful.
Hey, wait a minute. I just moved in my house. I can't sell it yet.
That's right. No, you don't have to sell your house. Just hang in there. Peter Riegert will be here to discuss his new film, which I saw last night, King of the Corner. Dark look at the midlife crisis. 27 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning's Edition.
Morning's Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo,
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. In just a little while, we're going to be talking to Cindy Sheehan out there at the Crawford Ranch. We're also going to be giving away another Chappelle DVD in just a little while. But now we have a guest in studio who made his name playing Donald Boone Schoenstein in Animal House. I'm sorry, we had to say it.
That's my life.
Yeah. And he
I'm
also
going,
starred
going
along
tomb with that.
He also starred alongside Burt Lancaster in Local Heroes. Local Hero. He's on the Sopranos as the assemblyman who gets the crap kicked out of him. I thought you did great at that. He's debuting his own project. The new film King of the Corner opens this Sunday in New York. This is the star co-writer and director Peter Riegert joins us in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Good
nice
morning.
To be here.
I tell you, I like movies like this. I liked your movie. I like dark movies that really get to the core of what human beings are about, because I believe that we're bitter and dark inside, and it needs to be reconciled.
That's why I call it a comedy.
Yes. Well, that's why. It's a great dark comedy. Boghossian's great in it. You were great in it.
Thank you.
What made you create this film? Is it something personal? Are you going through some of this stuff?
No, I started directing about 5 years ago. I found a short film based on an O. Henry short story called By Courier. So I was trying to just add things to my life, because the natural order is you get older and the parts become fewer and the competition becomes greater. So I had some success with that. And based on showing that, I got sent a collection of short stories called Bad Jews and Other Stories, written by this professor.
You're talking to one right here.
I'm a bad Jew.
They're all bad out there. Anyway, so he sent me this collection, and I really just fell in love with the material and optioned it from him, and he co-wrote it with me. His name is Gerald Shapiro. He's out in Lincoln, Nebraska. And really, for me, it was just connecting to the material. I wouldn't say I was identifying with Leo, this main guy's problems, but at least in my experience as an actor, it's the whole core of the piece, the sound of it, how its rhythms,
yeah,
and it's just connecting to the storytelling. So it wasn't so much that I was going through it, although as I've been, I've been on tour with this thing for 6 months now, and people keep asking me, is this autobiographical? And I keep saying, well, all creativity is autobiographical. But I have to pay attention, because maybe they're telling me something I don't know.
Well, I don't think it could be as a, like you'd have not led as disappointing a life as this main character, certainly. But it was interesting, and when you were just describing the film and show business in general, how you said that it gets more competitive, you get older, and you can't get parts. So on that level,
it's like life.
That's part of the story. You get a guy who's older. He's been at a job a long time, and he's got a young gun coming up under him, and you know, he's a little threatened by his job.
Well, I think if I could relate to anything specifically, it's the fact that I think this character in general has realized he's painted himself into a corner over time. I don't think he knows that he's particularly unhappy.
Right.
But it, in the series of events that reveal who he is to himself and to everybody else, he can't even answer the question, what does he want?
I mean, that was a great part.
Yeah. And I think that that's what, it's the whimsy of that kind of thing that intrigued me, that this guy Shapiro saw that all of our emotions coexist at the same time. It's just that the events draw them out of us.
Yeah.
You ever been in a, you know, some place that's supposed to be somber and you find yourself
laughing?
Yeah,
of course.
Or vice versa.
Yeah.
I mean, that's because you hold all of these issues together.
That's how I wake up. Every morning.
You wake up somber and laughing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a good name for a law firm. Yeah. Somber and laughing.
There you go. Peter Riegert, you're doing something unusual with King of the Corner. You're going out on the road with it. Why?
Well, I tried to get a traditional distribution deal, and essentially what I heard from the people who handle all kinds of films, but specifically independent, and I mean low budget, because we made this for $500,000.
Really?
Yeah. What they said was, we like your film, but we don't know how to market it. And I thought, well, you're just being polite. I mean, isn't it your job to figure out how to market it, especially if you like it? But there was some kind of disconnect in terms of what they weren't seeing dollar signs. So I knew I had a contract for a DVD release October 25th, and I said to my partner, who's the producer, Limor Sivan, why don't I just take this on the road and we'll see what kind of trouble I can get into. So we had our world premiere in Lincoln, Nebraska on March 4th.
Big Jewish town.
Huge, huge conclave of the tribe. And I've been crisscrossing the country for those 6 months. I have another month to go, knowing that we'd save Los Angeles and New York till later for economic reasons.
But you know what's hilarious is I'm listening to you saying this, and that's exactly like the father character.
Yeah, it turned into the character of the
Willie
father.
Willie Loman sort of salesman kind of character.
I've become this
Eli
guy.
Wallach has done this show.
He's
the best.
He mentioned the film, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. Good for him.
But now, wait a minute. You know, you said something that just struck me just now.
Mm-hmm.
You said, well, they came to you, and these were indie people, and they kind of gave you a stock Hollywood answer. Aren't indies supposed to be different?
This is my experience. There is no difference, whether it's for a lot of money or for a little amount of money. It's the same misunderstanding and guesswork that goes into a $100 million movie as goes into a $500,000 movie. Why should the people who are dabbling in the smaller universe be any better than the others? That's not been my experience. I think it's screenwriter William Goldman's famous admonition that nobody knows anything with regards to Hollywood.
Yeah.
It may be true about life, but he was speaking specifically about show business. And you know, beware of experts, essentially. I mean, these people are paid lots and lots of money to have an opinion, and I just happen to disagree with it. I mean, they do get it wrong most of the time, matter how successful they are.
It seems they're paid lots of money to have an opinion, but also to protect themselves if that opinion is wrong, to have someone to blame underneath them.
But everybody's looking for a market. There must be 1,500 to 2,000 so-called independent films, and that brings up a whole other question. What's the definition of independent? It's lost its meaning.
Yes.
If you can make a $20 million movie so that you can keep your street cred as being able to say you're independent, and there's another world. I mean, we shot the film for $400,000. I don't know if it made me more independent because it was cheaper or because that's the way I think. I mean, Steven Spielberg makes independent movies. Nobody's going to tell him what to do.
Yeah.
So he's essentially independent.
But he can get a pretty big loan.
Well, he can. And obviously, I'm sure it affects the work that he does because he's got to be responsible to people giving money.
Yeah.
However, he's still functioning independently.
But that company's on the block as well. I mean, you know, DreamWorks somehow or another is, you know, being sold.
Every company. It's Darwinian. If you ever had any doubts about whether Darwin was right, go into show business. I mean, it's survival of the fittest, and if you don't adapt, you die. I mean, that's just the way it goes.
Now, in the film, you were able to shoot it not for only for a reasonable budget, but to use some great talent. And I'll tell you, movies like this, years ago, there was a movie that Michael Caine did called Shock the System.
I did it.
You were in that movie?
Yeah, I played the guy who kills me.
Oh, that's right. The plane. You were in the plane?
Or no, he blew me up in a boat.
Oh!
Very distinguished.
Yeah. Now I feel bad because that movie, in terms of as dark as you can get with a similar type of theme,
that was
this
a black
film.
Comedy.
Yes. And then you had that movie just last year, In Good Company, with Topher Grace and the other guy, Dennis Quaid, which was a little lighthearted. And this movie, I think, is like the happy medium of really dealing with the emotions of an older guy, not old, you know, who's just, you know, coming into that part of his life where he realizes he resents young people.
Well, I think that, what's the sleight of hand here is that it's about a guy in his 50s having this crisis. So it's easily dismissed as about a midlife crisis.
Yeah, no.
When the truth is, his problems are the crises that anybody faces at any time in their life.
Sure.
Whether they are going off to college, what do they do in their 20s, what are my 30s like? I mean, the first time you go to kindergarten, it's a crisis. So
Right. That's
what I found fascinating about this guy's material, I mean, the writer,
is
that he took things that we face on an average day in a common way and presented them in a witty, humorous package.
Yeah.
And with people that are interesting.
And you had Dominic Cernese in there.
He plays the funeral director.
Uncle Junior. Eric Bogosian, who's on our show a lot, who was great as a rabbi. Beverly D'Angelo, who I haven't seen in a while. She was excellent.
Oh, yeah, good company.
And the guy who played your boss. What's that guy's name? He always plays that kind of heavy boss.
Oh, Harris Yulin.
Yeah, he's a very
fantastic
guy.
Actor.
It's a great cast, and the film. The thing I like is that you've built sort of a career on playing, you know, mildly sleazy guys.
If that's the impression I'm giving off, I'm in big trouble.
No, but you know what I mean. Not sleazy, but disingenuous.
But I don't play in my head, you know, as an actor.
Yeah.
I'm not editorializing my performance. I'm not saying to myself, oh, there's a quality of sleaziness to this guy. It's the nature of the conflict for the character that maybe suggests that they're sleazy or whatever.
Well, that's what I liked about this character is that he does, you know, he has a catharsis. And he has a moment where all those things are answered for him and that his life can sort of pick up pace in a very present, real mode for him where he has some resolution. And a lot of that, you know, I don't want to give away anything, but it is a movie that certainly, like, I like. I'm 41 years old, and it resonated with me because of the relationship you had with your father.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that people your age are going to resonate with this because there is a satisfaction and there is a movement through emotional problems.
Well, the four things that you hit upon, relationships, work, job, and there was one other you mentioned, family, I guess.
Yeah.
Father, son, father, daughter, job, insecurity.
Yeah.
And just the effect of time on all of us eventually.
Sure.
You know, you can fake it for a while most of us are.
Okay.
You know, you can charm your way through your 20s and kind of joke and needle your way through your 30s.
When does that wear off? Is it wearing off? I'm not charming?
I think in 7 months you're going to have to start to make a huge adjustment.
Damn it.
But you're looking good for now.
Thanks.
Now, this is here in New York at the Metro, New Metro Cinema.
Right.
100th and Broadway. It's here for a week.
Well, it's here until it doesn't make any money. They'll keep us going.
An extended run. When will it be distributed nationally, do you
think? This is the national tour. I didn't have a marketing budget to open it in 10 cities this week and 10 cities next week. So what I wanted to do was use 7 months to go all over the country and get some name recognition, as many good reviews as we can get, and also cast recognition. So for the DVD release, which is October 25th, I think, it won't be like dropping it in the middle of a pit.
Okay.
That's the only way that I could figure out how to do this. And by getting into Los Angeles and New York and getting critics like, I think Roger Ebert was great. He gave us 3.5 stars.
Oh, good.
Kevin Thomas gave us a great review in the LA Times. But we've done well all over the country. You just need a national critic to help legitimize all the other critics.
Well, here he is, right here, Mark Maron.
Peter Rieger, you got an Academy Award nomination for The Short. You know, I certainly wish you the best of luck with this film. I enjoyed it. It's a very real, grown-up, moving movie about grown-up stuff, and I think it's great that you're doing that.
Well, I'm going to also answer some questions from the audience Sunday through Thursday, I think, after the 4, 6, and 8 o'clock show. So if you want to come down and...
You're going to get a lot of these. So, dude, when you were working with Belushi, you know, when you were Boone, could you do that thing from the movie?
Largely, I do get that, but with English accents, it's very strange.
Oh, really?
There you go.
Not teasing.
Right.
Yes, I do get that, but not that's not so bad. Usually on certain radio stations that are not.
Right.
Not this one, just right. By, you know.
Yeah, they play the clips.
Oh, my God, it's just haunting me.
All right, well, we didn't do that. We'll do it when you're gone. Peter Rieger, thanks for being with
us. Thanks a lot.
Good luck
thanks,
with the film.
Thanks very much.
46 past the hour. We'll be back. Cindy Sheehan's coming up. And also, we're going to be talking to Natasha Richardson in a little while. So stay with us. 46 past the hour. I already said that. Hang out.
You know, whoever with this phone system can themselves in the mouth and eat their own waste. You know, that's what I say. So leave me alone. I'm trying to get a good take and replay it back on my touch tone pad. So can I play and get a good recording so I can hear how it sounds? I got an inconsistent mental disposition.
Next message.
Morning Sedition. On Air America Radio.
That to our pledges. Only we can do that to our pledges.
Yeah, that's Peter Rieger. He just left our studios. I told him we were going to do that. You know, it's interesting. In a few minutes, we're going to have Cindy Sheehan. We're also going to have a Dave Chappelle DVD giveaway. How many shows can you actually hear someone say that on?
One.
That's for sure. You know, it's interesting that we had one of the stars of Animal House in here because an annual report from the nonprofit testing company ACT Incorporated. I took the ACT. That's something you get on the West Coast.
I took the SAT.
Right. A lot of people on the East Coast say SAT. More people think that's more legitimate, but I took the SAT. But this study found that hundreds of thousands of this year's college-bound high school graduates aren't prepared enough academically to succeed in college. You know, I can certainly say for myself, Riley, apparently about half of test takers lack at least some reading comprehension skills. Suggesting they would struggle in courses like history or sociology, literature. Just over half, 51%, had scores high enough to suggest they could succeed in college-level social science courses. Just over half. 41% had scores indicating a high probability of succeeding in college algebra. 41%, that's Bush's poll ratings. And I'm sure that's about where he is algebraically. 26% scored high enough on the science test to indicate they're likely to succeed in college biology. 26%. I got to be honest with you. In high school, you know, I'm surrounded by guys. You got guys, even Big Anthony over there, our intern, much more disciplined and well-schooled than I.
No, he just talks better.
Brendan and PW, Brendan, PW McDonald, Dan Pashman, guys who did their homework. Right, guys who did their homework. I didn't do my homework.
Me neither.
Yeah, you didn't either? I mean,
no.
When I graduated high school, I'll tell you, I went into college. I had no idea what the hell was going on. I literally, even when I graduated college, I didn't know how to rent an apartment. I didn't know how to do nothing. I didn't realize that you didn't have to have all the money to buy a house last year. You know, there are certain things about being a grown-up that I just didn't know. And certainly college, if I didn't possess some of the facilities of charm, I don't know how the hell I would have gotten through it. In high school, chemistry, are you kidding me? They invented a grade. She gave me an E just so I wouldn't fail. I had no idea. I used to sweep through English. I mean, I don't know how the hell. In my last year of high school, because I was one of those kids, it was always sort of like, you know, he's got motivational problems. You know what I mean? He doesn't concentrate. And it was true because the last year I got straight A's because I panicked. I thought I'd never get out of Albuquerque.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that because for me, it wasn't an entire year. For one semester, the first semester of my junior year in high school, after flubbing around for the first 2 years of school, I said, okay, well, let me see what I can do. And I got like a 94 average and then slipped right back to where I was.
I gotta be honest with you. This job is the most disciplined I've ever been in my life. I wish my parents had made me do my homework. I wish somebody had instilled that in me. Of course, I would have resisted it at the time. But man, if I just had those study skills, it's one of the few regrets I have in my life. And I've done some pretty nasty things, though they were fun. But one of the few regrets I have in my life is not actually learning some work habits.
Really? You come in every day.
No, I'm telling you. That's what I said. This job. You know, I mean, I was a comic for 20 years. What does a comic do? A comic lives like a teenager who doesn't have to go to school. I mean, that's basically what that is.
There are people in this business who live like teenagers who don't have to go to school.
Hello. That's why I'm here. But I come in, I do my homework. I've never done more homework in my life. And I'll tell you, I got the same reaction to doing the work as I did in college. When I sit down to go over the stories at night after we talk about it, I'm like, damn it, do I got to do this? I'll call my wife. She's like, I'm tired. I don't want to do it. But I'll do it. I'll there do it for you, you people. Hey, you know what time it is?
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
That's right, Riley. It's time for our last Chappelle DVD giveaway. We've got one more copy of Dave Chappelle's Uncensored Showtime special, Dave Chappelle, For What It's Worth, on DVD. That comes to us courtesy of Sony Pictures Home Entertainment. We're asking listeners to guess what character Dave Chappelle is doing in clips from The Chappelle Show, like this one.
The only way I open the studio up now, y'all got to walk uptown to the Bronx and get breast milk from a Cambodian immigrant. Breast milk.
Mary from Brooklyn identified that as Dave Chappelle doing P. Diddy from Making the Band.
Uh-oh.
So here's the final clip, folks. And the first caller to get it right when we open the phones will win Dave Chappelle's Uncensored Showtime special on DVD. All right, ready? All right, since it's the last one, this one's going to be a quick clip, like 2 seconds. All right? Who is Dave playing here?
Is anyone up for a game of basketball?
That was fast. All right, play it again.
Is anyone up for a game of basketball?
All right, so the phones are now open. 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
What?
866-303-2270.
Yeah!
We'll get our final winner when, as we continue the show in just a few minutes, and we'll see who wins that. Man, it's amazing when you're giving someone away those phones. Bam!
Of course!
Bam!
It's one of the magic things about radio.
That people like free stuff.
Absolutely. They've gotten used to free stuff.
They get free stuff anyways. I like free stuff.
Yeah.
Swag.
And then we don't even say, well, tell us what station hooked you up with the greatest prizes.
We're going to start.
Oh, yeah,
we're going to do that after.
Oh,
but
okay.
I want you to do it like that. No, which station? I want you to do it like that. And then I'll go.
What?
All right. But we do give away stuff. I'd like some new T-shirts for our show. I mean,
yeah.
If I could reach out to the people downtown, the people in charge, wear our Morning Sedition T-shirts. We're tired of just the little silly Air America chains.
What about a free trip to Brazil for two or something?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Free Brazilian trip.
Train
for me.
That bad boy out.
Yeah, and some shirts.
Yeah.
And now I feel stupid asking for shirts. I'd like to go to Amsterdam.
There you go.
We'll come back with Cindy Sheehan and the winner of our Chappelle giveaway. It's 57 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Blah, blah, blah.
6 past the hour, folks. Good morning. How are you? What's going on, geniuses, philosopher kings, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives who have had their day? I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
You forgot Queens.
Oh, I did?
Yeah, you just said philosopher kings.
I'm sorry.
Don't leave the women
philosopher
out.
Philosopher queens. I'm sorry. I got a computer thing going. We're doing some stuff here. You know what? I think this virus has gotten a hold of us, Riley.
Oh, man. Not another one of those.
Well, no. I just think that, the computers are a little screwy over here today. And, you know, it's sort of a pain in the butt. You know? But what are you going to do? These things happen when you give everything that the society has to offer, including your consciousness, over to machines. Man, you forget just how much you depend on these damn things until something goes wrong.
Yeah.
So we got some people on the phone. We got our Dave Chappelle giveaway here. We're giving away, of course, Dave Chappelle's For What It's Worth, courtesy of Sony Pictures Home Entertainment. It's the Showtime special, Uncensored. Here is what people had to identify. Tim?
Is anyone up for a game of basketball?
That's a quick one, but, you know, Dave Chappelle fans should know exactly who that is. Let's take this call. Carlos, how are you, Carlos? What's up?
Hey, what's up, guys? It's Prince, man.
What?
You gotta say it again, man.
Prince, man. He's imitating Prince, man.
What?
Sorry, I can't help myself.
There you go.
All right, buddy. Yeah, you got it right, man. So, where are you listening to us?
9:40 in Miami, man. It's funny because I'm on my way to work. I've never won anything. I never called a radio station or anything, but I love you guys and I love Dave Chappelle, man. So
it worked out, then. You don't have this DVD?
Nah, man. You know, I got to work all the time, and I don't have too much cheese, man, you know.
I hear you. Well, thanks for listening, Carlos, and I hope you enjoy the DVD. Stay on the phone so he can get your information.
All right.
All right, guys. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks. Carlos. Look at that.
Wait a minute. We forgot to do the special. What radio station hooks you up with the greatest prizes in the world?
Well, he did. He actually he gave us some props. That's kind of nice. So where are we at now, man? I would like to. I guess we have Cindy Sheehan on the phone in just a few minutes.
Yes.
We got Natasha Richardson coming up as well. You know, out there, you know, we were listening earlier to the blowhard Rush Limbaugh.
Oh, that idiot.
These guys, their perception of reality is breaking down, Riley. The construct that they are presenting as reality is breaking down, and a lot of that is because of Cindy Sheehan. Hey, Tim, will you just play me that Rush clip real quick? Can you? Do you have it?
I mean, Cindy Sheehan is just Bill Burkett. Her story is nothing more than forged documents. There's nothing about it that's real, including the mainstream media is glomming onto it. It's not real. It's nothing more than an attempt. It's the latest effort made by the coordinated left.
Well, thank you for calling us Coordinated Rush. And also, what does that mean, fabricated? There's no fabrication here. He couldn't even get behind that. He couldn't even commit to it. It's breaking down, Riley. The reality that they're clinging to, that they've manufactured and made up through a series of repetitions, talking points, mantras of belligerence and hate, are breaking down. You know why? Because Bush's approval rating is at 41% right now. The highest approval rating he has on a statewide level, 59% in Idaho. He's got Cindy Sheehan basically sitting on his fence saying, answer for this, answer for the life of my son, answer for the life of these other people that have come here with me to protest because they lost loved ones. Answer to that. So what does Bush do? Next week he's flying to Idaho where people like him, 59% of the people, and he's avoiding everything to stay tucked away in a non-reality. We have Cindy Sheehan on the phone out there in Crawford. Good morning, Cindy. How are you feeling today?
I'm just feeling great. How are you guys doing?
All right.
We're great, man. Cindy, we're so happy you're with us. We were just talking about that horrendous Rush Limbaugh and that swag. He tried to swag you yesterday by saying you're making stuff up, which is ridiculous.
I know. He said something like, I'm not real and Casey's not real.
He said her story is nothing more than forged documents. What does that even mean? He couldn't even get behind it. It doesn't even make sense.
What documents are forged? Did they forge my son's death certificate?
Exactly. What an idiot. I mean, it's like that's such a scraping of the bottom of the barrel. He couldn't even get it behind it himself. So, look, we hear that a lot of more people who have lost people in the war are flocking out there in the last couple of days. Have you met up with a lot of new people out there?
I have, and I actually met a lady that I never knew before that's not in my organization, but she's going to join, and her son was killed in February, and she has a t-shirt with her son's name on it, and on the bottom it just says Y.
Yeah, I hear you. So now you've got all those crosses that were plowed over by that moron back up, and you're in the new property, are you, yet?
We're moving today.
And I heard you got some tents donated to you.
We got some tarps from donated to us unwillingly from Fort Hood, Texas.
Now, Cindy,
I didn't know it, but thank you.
Cindy, I understand that Colleen Rowley, who's the former, she's the FBI whistleblower, you met her in Dallas earlier. Is she there with you now?
She's coming today, and so is the Minnesota State Legislature. State legislator whose son was killed in Iraq. She's coming today, too.
And did you hear...
It's either Minnesota or Michigan, one of those states, I don't know.
Did you hear that Bush is now going to take a vacation from his vacation to avoid you even more? He's going to go to Idaho.
I didn't hear that. I heard you guys talking about it, though.
He's going to Idaho. This is the only state that kind of likes him. His approval rating's down to 41%, and in 59% of the people polled in Idaho like him. So instead of talking to you, next week he's going to run to Idaho to try and hold on, to try and get some love.
Wow.
What a bastard.
Well, maybe we have some people in Idaho that'll make things uncomfortable for him.
I hope so. So
yeah.
There's at least 36% out there that are on certainly against him. So what's on the agenda for today? Have you had breakfast yet?
Haven't had breakfast yet. We're going to have a mom's day where we're going to come and write letters to Laura Bush to request that she request of her husband that he meet with me. And I think besides the move and that, that's about the last thing on the agenda. And I was just on the Drudge Report, and I just want to let you guys know, and I want to let America know that once in a while I cuss.
You cuss.
Once in a while, I say the bad words that my mom would have washed my mouth out with soap.
Oh, boy, they're really grabbing at straws, aren't they?
So they printed a speech that I said at San Francisco State University that has some cuss words in it. So, you know, I hope America's not too shocked when they find out that I use those words.
I tell you, I can't even imagine who is buying that crap from these guys. I can't even imagine who, you know, just by virtue of the fact that, what have you had, maybe like 5 counter-protests down there?
Yes, exactly. You know, 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 a day.
Nothing.
You know, people aren't, like I said, this is supposedly Bush country, and that's the best they can do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're pretty nice. We make sure they have enough water and everything. So,
that's really good.
Know?
You're
giving
them more slack than they're giving you. Cindy, do you believe now that President Bush can empathize with you and other parents who have lost children in this war who may oppose? Do you think he's capable of that?
I don't really think he is. He can say everything he wants, but, you know, the thing that proves to me that he doesn't is they're still over there. You know, they're still over there in this war that's been proven to be lies. You know, and there's no talk of exit strategy or leaving, and because we know they don't plan on it. They're building bases the size of Sacramento, California over there. They plan on never leaving, and unless we the people make them, they won't.
I'll tell you, the aristocratic arrogance of this guy to, number one, not talk to you, and then number two, to just go bike riding with Lance Armstrong, to say things like he's got to get on with his life, and then to leave next week and go to Idaho. The arrogance, what does he think he is, a king?
I sure hope he's, able to get over my son's death. You know, I hope that it doesn't weigh too heavily on his brain. You know, that is just, it's very arrogant, and,
So what about this? What about this Friday? What about this Friday? Are you going to? I heard that there's a nationwide moment of silence. Is that going to happen?
We're going to do a worldwide moment of silence. Mm-hmm. There, we had invited George and Laura down with us to pray with us, and we hear that they probably won't.
Really, that's weird. They're religious people. I can't understand.
But, you know, and George Bush says, you know, he cares about the troops, and we're praying, and he cares about the. It's for the ones who have already been killed, and the. Ones who are in harm's way to pray for them and their families. And, you know, he says he cares. This would be a nice way to demonstrate it.
Maybe he prays on his bike.
Is that why he runs into policemen in Ireland and stuff?
Exactly.
He's
in the middle of prayers on his bike.
Yeah, right.
All right, Cindy, well, thanks. It's great talking to you.
Thank
be careful.
Guys.
Take care. All right.
Talk to you tomorrow.
All right, bye-bye. 16 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. That was Cindy Sheehan, and we'll be checking back with her again tomorrow. We're going to have actress Natasha Richardson in just a little while. And, you know, stay here. It's been a great, great morning. 16 past the hour, as I said, Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark.
Morning Sedition.
This is to wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks. Twenty-one past the hour. How about that? 21. Yeah. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. How are you, Mark? You all right?
Yeah.
You know, what are you going to be doing tomorrow morning? Because we are we're going to Harlem. You going with me?
No.
Come on! You can't leave me up there by myself. We will be at Amy Ruth's in Harlem. We'll have pro wrestler Mick Foley with us, comedian Mike B., best-selling author Bret Easton Ellis. There's going to be some free coffee, good food. I hear it's got the best salmon cakes around.
Yeah, well, Foley's got your back, but don't worry about it.
Yeah, no. You're coming up there
Foley
with me.
Foley and Neil. Our man Neil. Take
it. Oh, Neil. He's great. He's got the easiest job in the world.
Yeah, right.
I swear to God, Neil is a guy who does security for us when we do the live remotes. Our biggest threat has been an 85-year-old woman who writes comedy. I'm not even sure she's that old, but Franny will come up to me and go, no, please, can I just talk to him? And then there's the next hour.
Yeah.
Right? You know, so Neil, his big security detail is keeping Franny away from me so I can have a Fanny. Fanny's her name, Fanny, man, so yeah. I can have a little free time. She's an adorable woman. I'm sure she's listening. I'm sure she'll be up in Harlem. I'd be surprised if she doesn't.
Oh, no, she's coming up.
That's Amy Roots on 106th Street between 7th and Atlantic Avenue. 116th, between 6 and 9 a.m. Of course, we look forward to seeing you all there. Last week, we found out the Republican Party. Natasha Richardson's going to be here, by the way. Yes. Last week, we found out the Republican Party is paying legal bills for a man who's charged with illegally trying to keep Democrats in New Hampshire from voting in a U.S. Senate race. James Tobin faces four felony charges of helping jam get-out-the-vote phone banks in 2002. He was also President Bush's 2004 campaign chairman for New England, and the Republican National Committee has kicked in around $700,000 for his defense. It's a pretty good story, but we think we can tweak it a little. On today's Morning Sedition Slander Minute, with our slander... with our Slander Minute correspondent, Ted Franks. Ted, what can you add to this story?
Well, thank you, Mark. I have it on super secret deep blue night vision goggles recreational snorkeling background that James Tobin once got rid of a couch by just moving out and leaving it.
Uh-huh. Well, that's not exactly a scandal.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like anything, Ted.
Well, that's because you guys don't rent out properties. Imagine you're a landlord. You've journeyed to the end of a lease and reunited with your refulgent and reflated rentable, only to find yourself the unwilling parent to scabrous paraphernalia, a warped wooden frame, upholstery commemorating the misguided color scheme of May 1973, and pillows infested with skin flakes and stained with the DNA evidence of goatish commingling.
It's still just a couch, man.
Yeah, Ted, the landlord probably just hired people to haul it off and paid them out of the deposit.
Well, yeah, that's what happened, but still.
What else have you got, Ted?
Well, Mark, I have it on super incredible Zoifter Freak Muck background that James Tobin, this Republican campaign official in New England, is actually a man.
Of course he's a man. His name is James.
Let me finish. He's a man posing as a woman. Posing as a man, like Victor Victoria, but in reverse, and for no reason.
What?
Yeah, I can't even follow that one, Ted.
Let me finish. Will you just let me finish?
All right.
He is living a lie as the truth, pretending to be someone he's not, pretending to be someone he is. This GOP fabulist, this partisan thimble rigger, this mountainous mountebank, megalithical meagle myth...
What else you got, Ted?
I have it on good authority that Dick Cheney was created using the same software program as Max Headroom.
Ted, go home. All right? Just go home. This has been the Slander Minute. Just go home, Ted. Go. Just come back next week. All right? You tried. That's our Slander Minute correspondent, Ted Fields.
I want to be important.
All right, look, you know, we've been talking. Thank you, Ted. You take care of yourself.
Thank you, Ted.
You try and come
be
up
cool,
with something.
Man.
The whimpering Ted. All right, you know, we found this story. Do I have time to do this? Maybe I do. Let's try it. This is from E.L. Doctorow piece written about a year ago that I found very compelling in response to Bush's inability to grieve because he doesn't know what death is. You know, E.L. Doctorow wrote Ragtime, City of God, Billy Bathgate. He's a great writer, a novelist, yes. Historical novelist. He understands history, but let's get into this. This is I'm going to quote from him. Yet this president knew it would be difficult for Americans not to cheer the overthrow of a foreign dictator. He knew that much. This president and his supporters would seem to have a mind for only one thing, to take power, to remain in power, and to use that power for the sake of themselves and their friends. A war will do that as well as anything. You become a wartime leader, the country gets behind you, dissent becomes inappropriate, and so he does not drop to his knees. He is not contrite. He does not sit in the church with the grieving parents and wives and children. He is the president who does not feel. He does not feel for the families of the dead. He does not feel for the 35 million of us who live in poverty. He does not feel for the 40% who cannot afford health insurance. He does not feel for the miners whose lungs are turning black or for the working people he has deprived of the chance to work overtime at time and a half to pay their bill. It is amazing for how many people in this country this president does not feel. But he will dissemble feeling. He will say in all sincerity he is relieving the wealthiest 1% of the population of their tax burden for the sake of the rest of us, and that he's polluting the air we breathe for the sake of our economy, and that he's decreasing the quality of air in coal mines to save the coal miners' jobs, and that he's depriving workers of their time and a half benefits for overtime because this is actually a way to honor them by raising them into the professional class. And this litany of lies he will versify with reverence for God and the flag and democracy, when just what he and his party are doing to our democracy is choking the life out of it. That's from E.L. Doxrow's piece from about a year ago, republished, not coincidentally, in the Houston Chronicle, which is very interesting.
Very interesting. And, you know, words that are going to transcend last year, this year, and several years to come.
Absolutely. Actress Natasha Richardson, who stars in the new film Asylum, will be with us after the break. So why don't you stay with us as well. It's 27 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
Terra America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Thanks for tuning in here. We got Bruce Cherry's going to come in a few minutes and pitch us a
new
bit.
Not again.
Yeah, it's the weekly Bruce Cherry pitch bit, which I'm looking forward to. I think he's getting a following, Bruce, because they don't like that I beat up on him. But right now, in the newly released Asylum, the film, our next guest plays an underappreciated and frustrated wife forced to find passion in the arms of a psychotic killer in a mental institute with devastating consequences. Tony Award-winning actress Natasha Richardson joins us in the studio. Good morning.
Morning, Mark.
Good morning.
So morning.
Weren't you just Blanche DuBois on Broadway?
Yes, I was.
You got the gravitate towards psychotic roles in codependent relationships?
I know. I don't know what's the matter with me and these crazy ladies, sex-addicted ladies who drink too much and smoke too much. I'm taking a break from them after this.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is this too draining? Too much fun?
Too much fun.
Too much fun. There you go.
Yeah, you're actually the first person that has to check into rehab just from roles they play.
Exactly.
So what's this film? What's the thrust of the movie? Ben, I'm saying that not in a sexual way, but I mean...
I think it's like a sort of exploration of dark, obsessional passion, really.
Mm.
And there are sort of various thriller elements, twists to mm-hmm. the tale.
And there's a lot of sex in the movie.
There is quite a lot of sex.
And now your husband is
Liam Neeson.
Now, when you do sex, is this some sort of competition you guys have? Because I saw Kinsey,
right?
And I saw his butt, and I saw him kiss a man. Now are you sort of like, I'm going to show him?
It does kind of seem like that.
But now, are you when you do that kind of film? Mm. I don't know. I have not talked to an actress who's done that. What happens on the set when you have to shoot a nudity scene?
Well, I think, it depends from movie to movie. I haven't done anything like that for a while, and I certainly haven't done any sex scenes like this before because the director wanted them as raw and real as possible. So I think this went as far as Last Tango in Paris almost.
Wow.
So what you see in the movie is just the tip of the iceberg.
You mean there was more that didn't make it into the
there's
film?
There was a lot more. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you have to have your husband on set? Was he just sitting there going, all right, please, time out. Please.
Definitely not. The first time I saw it with my husband, I was just dying.
Oh,
and,
my
like,
God.
I wanted to slide under the floor.
What was his reaction? What did
I'm sorry to be boring about it, but we kind of keep a professional distance with these things and sort of don't comment on it too much with each other. Because it's a weird thing to watch. It's a weird thing to do.
Okay, wait, so you're in the movie theater with your husband, Liam Neeson, and he's watching you as you're watching you on a screen, having sex,
right.
Naked, and you just walk out, and he says, good job.
Let's keep it professional.
Yeah. Yes, yes, he's commenting on my performance, so to speak.
Okay, all right. All right, that's good.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know how I'm going to follow that with another question.
Well, yeah, no, let's bring it back down to the respectable level.
What drives, right? I mean, obviously, aside from the sex, what drives your character? I mean, this is a woman who falls in love at a mental institution? Not even falls in love, has an affair at a mental institution.
She has an affair because her husband works and lives in a mental institution. He's a psychiatrist there, and it's 1950s England, which was a very suffocating, constrained, class-ridden society. And the role of women in 1950s England, like it was in America to a degree, was very sort of Stepford wife land. You know, you are there to be the dutiful wife and serve your husband and maybe have coffee mornings with the girls, but you certainly didn't have a job or any really, you know, creative outlet. So I think that's what leads her, and she's in an unhappy marriage, that's what leads her to fall for really the wrong guy. But she doesn't think he's completely crazy. That's
so
what
she
is.
Believes him. She believes him.
I think she thinks that he's rehabilitated and he's a misunderstood artist who committed a crime of passion and,
sounds like every relationship like that, you know, when you got the weird codependent relationship with a guy who's evil. I mean, think, you know, Hitler had a girlfriend. You know?
Yeah, exactly. There are always moments in life where, I mean, I think a lot of women have fallen for the wrong guy or the right guy at the wrong moment, you know?
Sure, yeah. Now, you come from, your mother is a very politically active person. Mm-hmm. You come from an acting family. Do you do you bring politics into your life? Are you a politically activated person?
I'm not a politically active person. I think that's one way in which I didn't follow in the family footsteps. I mean, as a citizen, of course, I have my views,
sure,
which I share with my friends, not publicly,
right,
because I don't feel in a position to do that. I'm only an activist for AIDS causes, really. I've done as much as possible in the
sure
fight against AIDS.
Oh, great. Well, you know, Vanessa Redgrave is your mom, yes?
Right.
Now, do you think that, because I remember she caused a big to-do when we spoke out at the Oscars, and do you think that had an effect on her career?
I do, yeah. It
really?
Definitely did.
Huh.
Yes.
Because she still works a lot. I think her performance in the lesbian woman in that on HBO.
Oh,
yeah,
that was amazing.
She was really amazing.
She was astonishing.
When you watch her, do you ever get that? I guess it's like a child rivalry. Do you just look at your mom and go, oh no,
How am I gonna follow that?
That's so good.
Oh, it's like inspiring.
That's
to watch
so great
her.
To have a healthy relationship with your parents.
Oh. Oh, yes. I mean, certainly in that respect.
Oh, that's great.
When do you decide, in terms of your work, that you have to take a break? That you've gone through, you've done a certain amount of
right
shooting, you've been working on a stage, you have a movie coming out, I think you're working on another film?
I have another movie coming out later this year, yeah.
The White Countess. When do you say, enough, it's time to chill out for a minute?
I've just done that, like, right now, because...
you're here chilling out?
When I've done this. No, because I have two school-age boys, and I shot a movie that took me to China for 3 months before Christmas, and then I did Streetcar on Broadway, and when you're on Broadway, it's very antisocial for kids because you can't get up with them in the morning because you've got to work late and you can't put them to bed at night. So anyway, having done this stretch of work, which was pretty emotionally draining, it's time, I think, to make my boys the priority in my life right now. So I'm going to take a break for the next few months.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
She's going to be a good mom as well. She likes her mom. She's going to be a good mom. Her husband lets her do sex scenes. This is the perfect... What a life you got going on.
Oh, it sounds so ideal, doesn't it?
Now, you were in China. You grew up in England and in other parts of Europe. You grew up in France as well?
I spent a lot of time in France, and my dad moved to L.A. when I was 10 or 11 years old, so I spent a lot of time in L.A.
Oh, that's odd.
Yeah.
So you're this international person, then you get stuck in that hellhole.
Yeah.
So how long did you...
He didn't see it like that.
He thought
he
it was great.
He just loved it. He hated England and just loved L.A. and the States.
Oh, my God.
And,
so how long were you in L.A. for?
I don't know. I mean, a lot. It was my home away from home. It was my dad's home. So I don't know. But what it's given me is a sense of I'm an American citizen now.
Uh-huh.
And
But the strange thing is I never really feel I belong anywhere 100%. I don't feel entirely English. I'm not entirely American. I'm not entirely European, although I went to a French school in London. I went to the French lycée there.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I'm a kind of wandering citizen of the world.
That's so great. I barely ever get out of the country. I need to go out of the country more because I don't have those experiences. It must be great to be able to have stories from China and France.
It is. It's fantastic. Yeah. I think.
Where were you in China?
I was in Shanghai.
That's one of those. That's a great, lively, kind of highly active city.
It's astonishing. It's like being in a boom town, a gold rush town. I've never experienced anything like it.
And you were shooting this, The White Countess?
Yes, there? Yeah, from Merchant Ivory, yeah.
Wow, this is a modern film from Merchant Ivory?
No, it's set, it's a sort of romantic, epic love story. Me and Ray Fiennes, and it's set in the fall of Shanghai in the 1930s.
Okay.
That's seems it. Like every movie that's made about Shanghai is set in the 1930s.
Right? Is it? What other movies?
There was an old movie. Actually, it was made in the 1930s. I can't even remember the name of it anymore.
No.
What was that god-awful movie that Madonna
was
showing?
Oh, Shanghai Surprise.
That was set in the 30s. And it was this weird movie about a woman who ran a casino. In the 19th. I can't even remember the name, but I've seen it like 5 times on the old movie network. And it there seemed to be something like really strange about Shanghai.
Well, I think it was a very hot period there in the 1930s. I mean, it was a really happening scene.
So is there opium smoking in the movie and like boats and
no,
rickshaws?
No, there's boats and rickshaws, but there's no opium smoking.
Is there any nudity? Is there anything that Liam's
no,
going to be uncomfortable with?
No, we don't even get to kiss in the movie.
Oh, really?
But it's still a love story.
It's unrequited love?
No, it ends up, it's a real heartfelt love story between a blind man and a white Russian refugee.
Woman. Oh, that one. Yeah, I've seen stories like that.
PG-13 love.
Well, look, the movie Asylum is opening when?
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. It opened last week?
It opened last week in New York and L.A., and I think it's coming out to other cities this week.
Tremendous. So, look, it was great having you here.
Thank you.
Natasha Richardson, great
thank
talking
you,
to you.
Thank you, Mark.
It's nice to have a woman in the studio, you know?
Yeah, we have to do this more often.
Will you come back?
I'd love to come back. I didn't know I was infiltrating a guy's domain.
No, it's not a guy's domain. It's just a weird thing.
Can you go by the chairs?
I'll tell you what. So tomorrow morning, you come in at 6. You'll
be in Harlem tomorrow.
All right, 44 past the hour again. Thank you, Natasha Richardson. It's great talking to you. The new film is Asylum. We'll be back with Bruce Cherry. Stay with us.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your vlog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Nine past the hour. Good morning. It's Mark Maron here with the just sitting down. Mark Riley.
I almost sat on the floor.
We can't. They bring the food in here on some days, and we can't even wait. We're going to land this thing now. You know, we got City Bakery stuff just came a day early because tomorrow we're going to be in Harlem up at Amy Roots.
Yeah.
Yeah. You might want to come down for that. It's going to be great, or come up for that, depending where you are. We got Mick Foley, comedian Mike B. We got Bret Easton Ellis is going to be there. Free coffee. They got the great salmon cake, so I can't say that's going to be free, but we'll be giving away some stuff. But they got good food up there. Riley
tells me. Salmon cakes, baby.
All right, that's Amy Ruth's on 16th Street between 7th and Lenox from 6 to 9 tomorrow morning. Wow, that's going to be a great show. It's been a great day. And right now, this is something we look forward to all week. I know maybe some of you don't listen to us all day, but a lot of you are familiar with our characters here. We have some very funny characters. We have the wonderful Jim Earle, who does a series of characters, the Mortensen fellas, the Milfingtons, the Sammy the Stem. So we got Barry Lank kicking up the Slander Minute now, and he's also a popular voice on Morning Sedition Radio.
Radio Theater.
Kent Jones, of course, with Lawton Smalls, very popular. And, you know, we have a writer. We also have Pendejo.
Yes, right, Tom the Johnson. Revolutionary.
But, you know, one of our writers who sits alone in his cubicle during the day listening to strange music from, you know, from days gone by. Bruce goes out of his way to listen to music that no one's ever heard of. So he can always be the guy going, what, you never heard of them? But anyway, so.
Don't like the mystery trend?
The mystery trend. So Bruce is dying to do a character, and he's been pitching some characters, and he comes in every week to pitch us a character. And this is Bruce Cherry's Pitch of the Week.
Yeah.
I want to congratulate you on being able to improvise that entire intro.
I don't need to read things.
Yeah, there was an absolute, I mean, I guess Outlook is out. And
did you catch a computer virus?
No, I don't have the. I don't have a computer.
Okay. So what do you got? You got something funny?
As you know, I think things through, right? Yeah. And everything is like it's very tailored to the news of the day. I'm thinking this is the impetus. I was thinking about Cindy Sheehan, right? Okay. And how she's being treated. Uh-huh. They had like some quotes, maybe spurious, that they attributed to her. The right wing did about her opinions on Palestine and Israel and everything. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And the thing that hit me was, you cannot have a left-wing spokesman unless they are absolutely perfect. They'll take the tiniest little thing, the smallest peccadillo of an individual, and they'll blow it up and they'll throw it in your face.
Right, absolutely.
So we want a spokesman on this show who absolutely has to be perfect, or bada boom, you turn it on its head. I've created a character and I will play it. Shenanigans, the clown who has sex with his dog.
Okay. Well, okay. Now wait. So how do we get from the perfect left spokesman to Shenanigans, the clown has sex with his dog?
As a perfectly vile entity,
yeah,
this individual is beyond reproach.
Okay, all right.
You can't.
Yeah.
He's totally free. He's transcended good and evil, and he can speak thus with utter moral clarity.
And he's a progressive, is he?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
He is our mouthpiece. And he is actually cannot be. No one can criticize
him. How does this play out for us?
Okay.
Yeah.
I get introduced.
Yeah.
You say some of the effect of now.
Shenanigans. The clown that has sex with his dog.
Indeed. And a couple of important points. It's not had sex, Mark, in which he would be remorseful. No. It's he has sex.
And
it's a continuing, ongoing thing. Emphasized it.
Shenanigans, clown that has sex with his dog.
And it's also his dog, too. It's not like you would have sex with a neighbor's dog just because you're angry at them or something.
His dog. Mm. Yeah.
And I think things through, right?
Okay.
You want to identify the dog. Maybe
right.
Viewers would suggest a dog. Golden Retriever.
Okay.
Because, I mean, you don't want a Lhasa Apso or a Dachshund or something like that.
No, because that's painful.
No, see, that's the kind of thing. We don't want to upset the listeners. Okay?
Right.
And that would definitely be tasteless. Sharpei?
No.
Disgusting.
No,
right?
You can't do
Golden
that.
Golden Retriever, that's an attractive dog,
and
right?
And Golden Retriever, takes, be excited about it.
And here's another, The first thing I threw it past the writers, and the first thing they said is, you know, you want to create the most evil entity possible so that he is inviolate in terms of being criticized. And the first thing they said was, there's a lot of worse things to have sex with than a dog.
Oh.
In fact, Barry was adamant about that. He started listing things.
Really? So you got some help from the other guys.
Is that an experience or
something?
That's
good. That's
I
good.
Don't think they understand. It's a fictional character, and you got to... It's a balancing act, right? You have to, like, hit a certain line.
Okay, so... Yeah. All right. So he's gonna have sex with other things as well.
He's not. You have to maintain a modicum of taste.
So what? But is the dog? Does the dog have a name? Are you gonna name the dog Sean Hannity, or maybe name the dog Rush?
That's a good idea. The dog is like that's the backstory for the character. Okay. The important thing, and this is the beautiful thing for
Literally.
you have your opinions, right?
Right.
And they're very important to you, and you want to get them on the air. And when you say
Go ahead, Bruce. Don't stop talking and look in the booth.
They seem to be very upset.
I'm just trying to figure out where. No, no one's upset. I'm just trying to figure out. So how does this? So how does this end, Bruce?
Well, it just kind of the music fades. No. First of all, you take serious policy questions.
Look.
This is the beautiful thing.
Yeah.
You have your opinions,
yeah.
and you want to say them, and people have. People will criticize you. They'll say, oh, he's this nightclub comic who has advocated bacon or against bacon. And
let's ask Shenanigans, the guy who has the clown who has sex with his dog.
I function as your mouthpiece, and it's added.
Oh, that's much
get
better.
This, yeah.
I'm not doing that. I'm not. I mean, it's hard enough being me that I got to defer to a clown that has sex with his dog. I'm not doing it.
Okay, I got another one.
What?
There's a lion tamer act, right? It's mother and daughter.
Yeah.
But there's more.
Yeah. That's the whole thing?
That's it.
All right. Come back next week, and we'll try to flesh this out. Have something to eat, Bruce.
Please. Shut up, Mark.
Shut up, Mark. For those of you who are just tuning in, that was Bruce Cherry, and here are the highlights from what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning's Edition Cliff Notes. A state-by-state poll reveals that President Bush is most disliked in Rhode Island and most popular in Idaho, a state he's never been to. Bush might still be popular in the rest of the states had he not set foot in them. He's on his way to Idaho to address his strongest base of support, Nazis. Many people say that they plan to work after retirement. People already notice elderly workers, particularly when telemarketers start out phone calls selling timeshares, but end them with some long, rambling story about their gallbladder operations. A testing agency is warning that many incoming freshmen are not prepared for college. On the plus side, more freshmen than ever know how to construct a beer bong. Worried college officials point out that many freshmen even lack the computer skills to purchase term papers over the internet. Okay. Hey, Bruce, what are you eating? Or did you write that one?
Eating? Right,
today's phrase, just drop it in the conversation. You're never going to see what Bush really went to Idaho for, folks. It's the white supremacist super summit. Wake up, sheeple. Bush poll numbers may be down in this nation, but in the Aryan nation, it's a pro-Nazi, pro-Bush landslide.
Whoa.
Tomorrow in Harlem, Riley.
Tomorrow in Harlem.
Amy Roots.
Welcome to my world.
116th Street between 7th and Lenox. Come on down. Mick Foley, Brett Easton Ellis, Mike B. Good show, Riley.
Good show. We're going to do it all again tomorrow in Harlem, Air America Radio.